Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning, and this is Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Crystalline Beek Larson and Andre Redatus. Hi, you guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, and we also have our dear friends and guests, Charles Olivier and Neil Waldrop. Well, good morning to you guys, too.
Good morning.
And good morning to you.
And Charles, all apologies to you for last week. We had technical difficulties, and we have had for a couple of weeks. And, it's a tough nut to crack because the Internet is such a newer technology still, and Blog Talk Radio is certainly a newer technology. So inherent in that are some issues that you never can foresee. And Charles tried to call in last week and couldn't get through. And we really missed your input, so we're so, so glad to have you here this week. And welcome
again,
to all
Paul.
Of our listeners. You bet. I'm glad you're here. And those have been following the last couple of months, actually. We started with the government on our neighboring planet, and Charles and Neil have been our guests for several weeks now, and it's been so great to have them. And we culminated the Seraphic Planetary Government, Paper 114, last week. And in anticipation of a study guide that Neil created that we have all enjoyed reading so much, and we hope that you, our listeners who have been following along, had a chance to download it and read it as well. We're going to be covering it today. It's called The Unceasing Campaign of the Master Seraphim. And I'm going to turn it over to Neil now and let him explain to us what he has in mind, and we'll go through this together. And thanks for listening, friends. Neil, take it away.
Thank you, Paula. I would second Paula's statement about listeners in the sense that if it is at all possible for you to download the study guide that we are going to read and discuss, it would be very beneficial for you to have it in front of you as we are talking. You can do that by going to the following website, globalendeavor.net, and the link for this document is toward the bottom of the home page. In any case, I would like to explain a little bit about how the document came to be written. This study guide explains, or does the best it can to explain, by asking questions, the work of the Master Seraphim. We prepared the study guide because the work of the Master Seraphim is the spiritual model for the project called the Global Endeavor, of which the website citation I gave you is the main website. But this study guide confines itself to discussing the work of the Master Seraphim. It goes on for 14 pages in body, and then there are 3 pages of additional material that we may or may not deal with on this program. That will be up to the other participants. In the study guide itself, it states at the bottom of the first page that it is mainly intended as a document for armchair or desktop reading by the individual reader, but that it can also be used as a tool for discussion in groups, provided that it is used selectively. In our case, we are going to go through it from beginning to end because we do not have to try to cram all the discussion into a single program, and we will discuss it until we finish. The other point that I would like to share with you before we start has to do with the way that the document is organized. The document is subdivided into 3 headings, the first of which is Origin on page 1, and then on page 3, History Since Pentecost, and then on page 8, Destiny During the Current Millennium. This was the best we could do to honor the comments by the author of paper 19. This is on page 215 of the Urantia book in the one column edition near the top. It's in section 1 of paper 19. I would like to read the 2 paragraphs that are relevant.
Okay.
The author states, "For example, the human mind would ordinarily crave to approach the cosmic philosophy portrayed in these revelations by proceeding from the simple and the finite to the complex and the infinite, from human origins to divine destinies. But that path does not lead to spiritual wisdom. Such a procedure is the easiest path to a certain form of genetic knowledge, but at best it can only reveal man's origin. It reveals little or nothing about his divine destiny. Even in the study of man's biologic evolution on Urantia, there are grave objections to the exclusive historic approach to his present-day status and his current problems. The true perspective of any reality problem, human or divine, terrestrial or cosmic, can be had only by the full and unprejudiced study and correlation of 3 phases of universe reality, origin, history, and destiny. The proper understanding of these 3 experiential realities affords the basis for a wise estimate of the current status." So, the author has stated simply origin, history, and destiny. In evaluating the Master Seraphim, we have a reasonable amount of information, but we cannot say that it is full and complete in the sense of being an entire statement for all future time. And so we used headings which are similar, but not quite the same. Origin, History Since Pentecost, and Destiny During the Current Millennium. I would comment that the 3rd heading takes account of the fact that the arrangements pertaining to the Master Seraphim were established at the time of Pentecost. And it is reasonable to wonder, at least, perhaps even to assume, that these arrangements will change at the time of the next planetary dispensation. But we have no information on that point. Now, at the top of the study guide, it states that if the study guide is used as the framework for a group discussion, the best way to start would be for participants to read the section on the Master Seraphim out loud. I would therefore propose that we proceed to do that, and I would like to divide the section into 3 portions, soliciting a volunteer to read the first part, which would be from the beginning of section 6 in paper 114 on page 1254 of the one column edition through paragraph numbered 5, The Angels of the Races. Who would like to read that portion?
I'll be glad to.
Thank you, Andre. Please go ahead.
Stop at the Angels of the Races or proceed
through
5? Read
through the end of that paragraph.
Okay. 6, the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision. When the first Governor General arrived on Urantia, concurrent with the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth, he was accompanied by 12 corps of special seraphim, Seraphington graduates, who were immediately assigned to certain special planetary services. These exalted angels are known as the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision, and are, aside from the over-control of the Planetary Most High Observer, under the immediate direction of the resident Governor General. These 12 groups of angels, while functioning under the general supervision of the resident Governor General, are immediately directed by the Seraphic Council of 12, the acting chiefs of each group. This council also serves as the volunteer cabinet of the resident Governor General. As Planetary Chief of Seraphim, I preside over this council of Seraphic Chiefs, and I am a volunteer Superniphim of the Primary Order, serving on Urantia as the successor of the one-time chief of the angelic hosts of the planet, who defaulted at the time of the Caligastia secession. The 12 corps of the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision are functional on Urantia as follows. 1. The Epical Angels. These are the angels of the current age, the dispensational group. These celestial ministers are entrusted with the oversight and direction of the affairs of each generation, as they are designed to fit into the mosaic of the age in which they occur. The present corps of epical angels serving on Urantia is the third group assigned to the planet during the current dispensation. 2. The Progress Angels. These seraphim are entrusted with the task of initiating the evolutionary progress of the successive social ages. They foster the development of the inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. They labor incessantly to make things what they ought to be. The group now on duty is the second to be assigned to the planet. 3. The Religious Guardians. These are the angels of the churches, the earnest contenders for that which is and has been. They endeavor to maintain the ideals of that which has survived for the sake of the safe transit of moral values from one epoch to another. They are the checkmates of the angels of progress, all the while seeking to translate from one generation to another the imperishable values of the old and passing forms into the new and therefore less stabilized patterns of thought and conduct. These angels do contend for spiritual forms, but they are not the source of ultra-sectarianism and meaningless controversial divisions of professed religionists. The corps now functioning on Urantia is the fifth thus to serve. 4. The Angels of National Life. These are the angels of the trumpets, directors of the political performances of Urantia National Life. The group now functioning in the over-control of international relations is the fourth group to serve on the planet. It is particularly through the ministry of this seraphic division that the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men. 5. The Angels of the Races. Those who work for the conservation of the evolutionary races of time, regardless of their political entanglements and religious groupings. On Urantia, there are remnants of 9 human races which have commingled and combined into the people of modern times. These seraphim are closely associated with the ministry of the race commissioners, and the group now on Urantia is the original core assigned to the planet soon after the day of Pentecost.
Thank you. I would like a volunteer now to read paragraphs numbered 6 through 12. Who would like to do that?
I'll be happy to do that. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Charles, you do it.
Okay.
Okay, Charles, go ahead. And Paula, I will ask you to read the concluding part after Charles is finished.
Okay.
Number six, the angels of the future. These are the protection angels who forecast a future age and plan for the realization of the better things of a new and advancing dispensation. They are the architects of the successive eras. The group now on the planet has thus functioned since the beginning of the current dispensation. Seven, the angels of enlightenment. Urantia is now receiving the help of the third corps of seraphim dedicated to the fostering of planetary education. These angels are occupied with mental and moral training as it concerns individuals, families, groups, schools, communities, nations, and whole races. Number eight, the angels of health. These are the seraphic ministers assigned to the assistance of those mortal agencies dedicated to the promotion of health and the prevention of disease. The present corps is the sixth group to serve during this dispensation. Number nine, the home seraphim. Urantia now enjoys the services of the fifth group of angelic ministers dedicated to the preservation and advancement of the home, the basic institution of human civilization. Number 10, the angels of industry. This seraphic group is concerned with fostering industrial development and improving economic conditions among the Urantia peoples. This corps has been seven times changed since the bestowal of Michael. Number 11, the angels of diversion. These are the seraphim who foster the values of play, humor, and rest. They ever seek to uplift man's recreational diversions and thus to promote the more profitable utilization of human leisure. The present corps is the third of that order to minister on Urantia. Number 12, the angels of superhuman ministry. These are the angels of the angels, those seraphim who are assigned to the ministry of all of the superhuman life on the planet, temporary or permanent. This corps has served since the beginning of the current dispensation.
Thank you, Charles. Paula, now would you please continue on to the end of the section?
When these groups of master seraphim disagree in matters of planetary policy or procedure, their differences are usually composed by the Governor General. But all his rulings are subject to appeal in accordance with the nature and gravity of the issues involved in the disagreement. None of these angelic groups exercise direct or arbitrary control over the domains of their assignment. They cannot fully control the affairs of their respective realm of action, but they can and do so manipulate planetary conditions and so associate circumstances as favorably to influence the spheres of human activity to which they are attached. The Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision utilize many agencies for the prosecution of their missions. They function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. While unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect. But aside from these many means of positive action, the Master Seraphim ensure planetary progress against vital jeopardy through the mobilization, training, and maintenance of the Reserve Corps of Destiny. The chief function of these reservists is to ensure against breakdown of evolutionary progress. They are the provisions which the celestial forces have made against surprise. They are the guarantees against disaster.
Thank you, Paula. We will now begin using the questions in the study guide as a vehicle for discussion. For the benefit of any listeners who may have joined the program recently, I would state that the study guide we are proceeding to discuss is a document that you can download from the Internet. The website is as follows, www.globalendeavor, one word, G-L-O-B-A-L, endeavor.net. The link to download the study guide is toward the bottom of the page on the home page of that website. So now we proceed to section one. I'm sorry, to question one of the study guide, which I will read. In section two of the foreword, a divine counselor states, God is a word symbol designating all personalizations of deity. He subsequently explains that when the authors of the Urantia book use the word God, it has seven possible meanings, including God the Spirit, meaning number three, and God the Supreme, meaning number four. On balance, it seems very logical to associate the work of the Master Seraphim with both of these meanings of the word God. In your view, does the association of the Master Seraphim with God the Spirit appear to be more significant and more intense than their association with God the Supreme? Alternately, are you inclined to reach the opposite conclusion so as to emphasize their association with God the Supreme? As yet another possibility, do you appraise these two relationships as being equally important? In any case, please explain your reasons. Who would like to answer that question, or have the first attempt to answer that question?
Yes, I like the way you latter phrase your answer. I will address the question, Neil.
All right.
In essence, it seems to me the Master Seraphim, in the course of their labors, would have a great deal to do with God the Supreme and not God the Spirit. They certainly would have, it seems to me, an indirect relationship with God the Supreme, the Infinite Spirit. But the Infinite Spirit is an absolute being that seems to have an overseeing capacity, albeit connected in many ways, particularly through the angels that are daughters of the Spirit. But I think their role as daughters of the Spirit is not the point. The Supreme Being, God the Supreme, is laboring in the grand universe, the universe of time and space, and the seven super-universes of time and space. And the field of operation of the Master Seraphim is very definitely on a planetary level in time and space. So it seems to me they would have a profound reciprocity of some kind in some way with God the Supreme for that reason.
Thank you. The next volunteer, or I will call on someone.
Well, I'll take a crack.
Okay.
I'm inclined to think that they are both equally important, and I think that their relationship to God the Spirit is their origin. Their relationship to God the Supreme is their destiny, and in that sense, we share that same destiny with them, but not the same origin. Yet we're all working for the same goals.
Thank you. It seems to me that both of you emphasize that there is clearly a connection between the Master Seraphim and both terms for God, God the Spirit and God the Supreme. I believe that Charles emphasized the connection with God the Supreme as his primary focus. I think you may have said, Paula, that you believe that the two focuses are about equal. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, inasmuch as origin, history, and destiny are all vital.
Yes.
I mean, it's hard to say one is more important than the other.
I agree with that. Anyone else on this question?
I was add that...
Go ahead.
There's another place where we're told that for us, all of the agencies of spirit that are working with us are sometimes indistinguishable. And so I do think in some ways it's difficult for us to delineate what agency is functioning from our perspective.
A good point. Yes, this is very difficult. This question is conceptual, and I think that many possible answers are certainly valid as hypotheses. Andre, did you wish to speak on this?
Sure. Yeah. What's interesting is where they're
spoken of, you know, other than in paper 114, is in paper 39, both in section 1 and in section 9. And let me just go to section 9 quickly, where they mention, they say, large numbers of the completion seraphim return to their native universes, there to complement the ministry of divine endowment by the ministry of experiential perfection. Nebadon is, comparatively speaking, one of the younger universes and therefore does not have so many of these returned Seraphington graduates as would be found in an older realm. Nonetheless, our local universe is adequately supplied with the completion seraphim, for it is significant that the evolutionary realms disclose increasing need for their services as they near the status of light and life. A key phrase there. Completion seraphim now serve more extensively with the supreme orders of seraphim, but some serve with each of the other angelic orders. Even your world enjoys the extensive ministry of 12 specialized groups of the seraphic corps of completion. These master seraphim of planetary supervision accompany each newly commissioned planetary prince to the inhabited worlds. Then in section 1, paragraph 12, they make this simple statement. Many of the Seraphington graduates, members of the seraphic corps of completion, who are associated with these seraphim, engage in extensive teaching in certain Salvington schools concerned with the preparation of the creatures of Nebadon for the relationships of the next universe age. So in the first place, they're speaking of the fact that these seraphim have progressed upward, and I may be jumping the gun here a little bit, so I won't go too far into this because I think your study may address this a little bit further in. But the Seraphington graduates are normal seraphim, but they have progressed up through the super universe, and upon leaving Uversa have gone to Seraphington, probably directly instead of going through Havona with their former charge, and have progressed through the circles of Seraphington to complete whatever it is that they complete there in the process of, it's hard to say what it would be. In some places it describes the seraphim as being perfect already and having to choose away from it, but it really what it seems to be is a cementing of perfection, sort of a making replete of that perfection so that it can't be undone ever. And when they're done with that course, which probably coordinates all their prior experience, they come back and they seem to have been, in some way, without them ever saying this exactly, supremacized. They have, they're coming back, and what they're doing is they're mainly offering their services, helping worlds that are moving toward light and life, and also those that as they say, are preparing the creatures of Nebadon for the relationships of the next universe age. And that must mean that they have something within their natures that has achieved this supremacy. So I would be inclined to agree with everyone who's spoken so far, but leaning toward the idea that they started off as creatures of the spirit and have become creatures of the supreme more and more as a result of all their experience and training.
It's very interesting. I think we will indeed have occasion later in our discussion of the study guide to comment on their experience, but you brought up an interesting point. On the one hand, the Master Seraphim are devoted to the plan of ascension, or at least the broad outline of the plan of ascension by developing more and more advanced civilizations and of human beings on inhabited planets. The plan of ascension is sponsored by all three members of the Paradise Trinity, the Father, Son, and Spirit, sponsoring that plan as individual members of the Trinity rather than as the Trinity. On the other hand, the progression of this age is closely associated with the unification of all human experience on finite levels, I should say all finite experience, human and otherwise. And that is the project of God the Supreme, or if you prefer, the Supreme Being. So I believe that all of you have highlighted valid elements that connect the Master Seraphim to both of these concepts, both God the Spirit and God the Supreme. And it may very well be that, as Andre has portrayed the circumstances, that the ascent of the Master Seraphim all the way to Seraphicton has in effect intensified their association with the Supreme Being, with God the Supreme. I don't state this as an infallible conclusion, because I'm certainly not infallible, but I'm trying to sum up the discussion that we've had. Does anyone want to add a further thought here before we go on to question two?
I would like to elaborate briefly. The relationship to God the Spirit, the Infinite Spirit, and the relationship to God the Supreme on a value level, I think, is equal. And I think Paula's highlighting of origin is an important distinction. But I think the relationship with God the Supreme is functional. On a functional level, or in a functional relationship, in a functional sense, the Master Seraphim are working intimately with God the Supreme because of the necessity to develop in time and space that which always existed in the central universe, the goal to go from imperfection to perfection, to light and life. So in a value sense, I think they're on an equal footing. In a functional sense, I believe they work closely, functionally, with God the Supreme.
Thank you. I would say, just as a matter of information to the participants, but also for the information of the listeners, that the spirit of this study guide is to encourage diversity of expression and pluralistic belief interpretations of various kinds. Therefore, I do not propose and will not, in any sense, foster a unified single opinion at the conclusion of discussion. I believe that all participants have made valuable points, and I would like now, if there is no wish for further comment, to go on to the second question.
I'm good with that.
All right.
By all means.
Let's do it. Question two starts with a paragraph at the bottom of page one, but it actually continues onto the top of page two with specific questions. So the paragraph at the bottom of page one is really a highlight paragraph, and the specific questions are those that begin at the top of page two. So I begin reading. Two, in the section of paper 38 that is entitled Angelic Natures, Melchizedek declares, quote, "Though seraphim are very affectionate and sympathetic beings, they are not sex emotion creatures. Nevertheless, in dealing with sex creatures, it is our custom to speak of those beings of more direct descent from the Father and the Son as the sons of God, while referring to the children of the Spirit as the daughters of God. Angels are, therefore, commonly designated by feminine pronouns on the sex planets." By Melchizedek, page 419 in the one-column edition, paper 38, section 2, in general. In other words, we should say she or her when we are referring to any seraphim, not he or him. Now, question A. Does it then become appropriate for us to understand the work of the Master Seraphim from some of the perspectives that have traditionally been considered feminine? For example, a disposition to serve, assist, and support without manifesting an active effort to direct, dominate, or control. If this interpretation seems persuasive, please analyze the implications for the ways the Master Seraphim work with human beings. If, on the other hand, you disagree with the conclusion stated above, please explain your own interpretation of the Master Seraphim's methods. Who would like to start?
Well, this question really intrigued me, Neil, because it really makes you think about what those different dispositions are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you have surmised that a feminine disposition is to serve, assist, and support without manifesting an active effort to direct, dominate, or control. That really intrigued me. Because we know there are two basic distinctions, and they do make it very clear that we are the sons of God and that the angels are the daughters of God. So I would agree with the assertion that their disposition is primarily to serve, assist, and support, and that they have no necessity to direct, dominate, or control. Probably the thing that intrigues me the most is the male aspect of that. I don't think of God as directing, dominating, or controlling. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Or as the masculine aspect of deity as directing, dominating, or controlling.
Well,
so that was the interesting distinction for me, but. I see that we're all inhibited by our use of language, and we have to, you know, in the benign sense, I can see that it is true. So,
Charles, before you proceed, let me interpret mm-hmm. the words of the question in a way that may be helpful. I phrased it very delicately. The perspectives that have traditionally been considered feminine. And that was quite deliberate because, in effect, we are partly talking about stereotypes that certainly do not apply to every single individual.
Mm-hmm.
And the question of directing, dominating, or controlling, likewise, is a stereotype that doesn't apply to every individual either. But we're talking now here in the question about the overtones and implications, and I certainly would like to yield to you, Charles.
Oh, thank you. It's hard to imagine a chief of Seraphim engaging in direction, domination, and control, but it's easier for me to imagine the Most High doing that.
Uh-huh.
So I agree with the initial premise of the question of considering the feminine. And I appreciate how I could read between the lines and how you struggle to word this. For obvious reasons, for good and sufficient reasons. The Seraphim are described in the Rancher book, which we just read, and I'll reread a few of those sentences. They cannot fully control the affairs of their respective realms of action. They can and do manipulate planetary conditions and so forth. While unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, they often act to intensify some higher ideal and so on. It seems to me the Master Seraphim, in a certain sense, are nurturing civilization. That's a bit of a stretch, but I'm at a loss to refine the statement, to refine the characterization further right now. They foster, they serve, assist, support, and there's nothing passive. I don't think the passive-active contrast is very useful here. It's rather a different mode of approach. It's all active. All these beings in the Seraphic planetary government are active. But again, the chief of Seraphim would reflect, it seems to me, the nature, the functional nature of the Master Seraphim. And these descriptions of service, assistance, supporting would seem to characterize, whereas the Most High, in some ways, would seem to me more fatherly. They step in immediately, and they take over immediately when mm-hmm. there's a situation. And somehow we have to learn on this planet, we should learn on this planet, how to divorce many of our cultural, anthropological biases with actual characteristics and higher ideals, which is what we're attempting to do here, and I think it's valid. But I do think the disposition to serve, assist, and support is an accurate, is probably an accurate characterization. It's persuasive.
Andre or Crystalline, would you like to contribute?
I'm chewing through this, and I've been as I was previewing the study guide both a few days ago and again this morning, I was looking at this and highlighting some of what you were saying, and there is that interesting thing, if you do look at now, especially in our society, how what were traditionally held ideas of masculine and feminine, for instance, or all of that, and I realize we're trying to transcend that and just use it as a framework for thinking.
Right.
I mean, that's really what this is about, because we know that. The master seraphim, or any seraphim, or cannot be contained by our itty bitty concepts of what it means to be a man or to be a woman. They transcend that. Their natures are above that, whether a little above or far above, in the case of some beings. So. As I'm thinking about it, I guess the main thing that occurs to me is I like that Charles hit on the word nurture, and to me the idea comes, okay, if I take just a general global concept and I consider that the means of moving things forward is to somehow create an environment that fosters what I'm trying to get, trying to move forward. That I highlight certain things, that I, I de-emphasize other things in the environment in the same way that whether it be a classroom teacher or a mother or anyone else would, set up their classroom, in a certain way, have certain things up on the walls and have other things not on the walls. If I'm an elementary school teacher, I'm going to have the letters of the alphabet up there because that's important at one point, or maybe I'm going to have the four seasons, just to take some trivial examples, things that I want the kids to focus on at that point. On the other hand, as in a family, the successful family cultures that I've seen have been ones where an environment is created where the kids feel safe, but they are also stimulated to think about things that they wouldn't be thinking about had the environment not provoked them to either have the freedom to do something or stimulate their ideas on certain things. So I think of homes that are filled with books, for one thing, in bygone days. Now homes that may have computers or whatever like that. And now translating that to the master seraphim, I just see them as acting as highlighters of culture. And I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but, how is it that they do highlight that culture? That's a good question, but I think that's what they do. They go ahead and they stimulate us to respond to our environment in ways that, for one thing, cause us to be more in touch with our inner life and more in touch with each other on a service level.
Andre, both Charles and Paula liked the phrase serve, assist, and support. I wonder if you are likewise in agreement with that phrase.
Yeah, I am. I like it all. I mean, that's part of what's difficult to respond to this is that it's just I don't want to just rubber stamp it. But you know, just developing it a little further, I think it's imagining it somehow nurturance and motherhood, in that sense, you know, we might be thinking of that as the feminine side, but in that broad sense, in that broad universal sense, that spirit, spirit and sun spirit sense.
Can I ask
so instead of rubber
too?
Stamping anything, the Master Seraphim might be sending text messages. Is that your thought?
You know, if they are, they're elevated above anything I can envision as a text message. They can say a lot more in 140 characters for a tweet than we could ever conceive of.
Sure. Crystalline, did you want to contribute? I'm sorry, go ahead.
We'll let Crystalline if she wants to jump in.
I have my phone muted for the meantime.
All right. So okay. I take it you don't wish to speak to this point at the moment?
Not at the moment.
Paula, it's for you then.
Well, as I read this study, Neil, and it's very thought-provoking, and I thank you so much for it, because it kind of gets you into thinking about these things and articulating what you've always thought about these things, say, the nature of the feminine aspect of God, to me, is the everywhere presence and the conditioning of space. And they are clearly working with the whole. They work with every aspect of the whole, the way right down to the individual, but they clearly work with the group just as a mother would work with a family. And I think, Andre, you brought this out too. They're dealing with the part and the whole, and that's their domain. And so they're coaxing and leading and gently nurturing. They are everywhere present. So that's what sticks out to me with the nature of their work.
Thank you. I think we've had an interesting discussion of that question, and I would proceed to go on with paragraph B, if that's agreeable to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Do the factors we have just discussed harmonize with the premise that the Master Seraphim, like the Guardian Seraphim, are required to respect human choices and decisions? After all, a mighty messenger tells us, man does not have unfettered free will. There are limits to his range of choice, but within the radius of this choice, his will is relatively sovereign. A Mighty Messenger, page 303 in the one column edition, paper 118, section 9. Further, the Chief of Seraphim states, neither angels nor any other order of universe personality have power or authority to curtail or abridge the prerogatives of human choosing, page 1246 in the one-column edition, paper 113, section 5. Given these understandings, what techniques can the Master Seraphim use in order to inspire, influence, or attract a human being toward methods and approaches that may help upgrade the existing practices of humanity associated with a particular material, mindal, or spiritual context?
Well, I would like to share another quote in relation to this, and it was one that I didn't see in your study. It's from paper 113, section 5, paragraph 4. In the life of the flesh, the intelligence of angels is not directly available to mortal men. They are not overlords or directors. They are simply guardians. The seraphim guard you. They do not seek to directly influence you. You must chart your own course. But these angels then act to make the best possible use of the course you have chosen. They do not ordinarily arbitrarily intervene in the routine affairs of human life. But when they receive instructions from their superiors to perform some unusual exploit, you may rest assured that these guardians will find some means of carrying out these mandates. Now, I know this is about guardians, but I think this is an attitude in general that the angels take. And I think what really intrigues me about this quote is when it says they do not seek to directly to influence you. You must chart your own course. But these angels then act to make the best possible use of the course you have chosen. And I think that
I agree completely with you. I agree with what you said in a conceptual sense. This does implicitly involve a comparison of the work of the guardian seraphim and the work of the master seraphim, and that element will be highlighted a bit later in our discussion.
Okay,
but you're nevertheless making very valid points here in terms of the inability, the lack of desire to dominate or to direct, which I think is certainly common to the work of both categories of seraphim. In regard to the choice you have made, that is a particular phrase that corresponds to the destiny guardians, the guardian seraphim.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas the master seraphim are seeking to propel humanity toward higher levels of civilization, and there is at least reason to wonder whether they are advocating certain changes, or at least seeking to foster certain ideas that may have begun to appear in a human intellect.
And again, groups do make choices.
Yes.
I would also like to comment. There are a couple of points that they make on these issues that I think are pertinent. One that continues to intrigue me is that we're told that they operate as ideational clearinghouses.
Mm.
And I've often wondered, you know, where do ideas come from? Like, when we're operating in the realm of high creativity, there are things that come to us that might be the result of some effort on our behalf, but it's hard to say that we're really responsible for the ideas that we have. I mean, what do we do in order to get ideas? They pretty much just come to our mind. Now, we have ideas that flash across our consciousness continually that we don't act on. So the action upon our ideas seem to me to be the act of our own will. But are all of our ideas our own will origin? I would conjecture that I don't think so. So that comes to mind as one way in which we're influenced. There's also the statement that we should tempt not the angels of our supervision. So they must have the ability to put certain challenges or certain difficulties, if you will, certain adversities perhaps, in our midst that we have to grapple with for the sake of our spiritual development.
I think that Crystalline has highlighted many elements that are very interesting in themselves. I wonder if someone else would like to comment on the meaning of the term ideational clearinghouses, because I do believe that it is directly related to the nature of the question that we're discussing.
Well, in terms of conceptualization, when an idea first appears, Nothing happens unless it's articulated from one
mm-hmm.
person to another. Human history has one of the lessons of human history is that ideas begin in the thinking realm, and then they're expressed in through words, and then acted upon. So if a person observes the nature of steam or nature of boiling water and steam from it, and has the notion of trying to compress it, and talks about that, someone else may then take it to putting it into a container, a furnace or a steel, an iron box, and eventually a steam engine will emerge from that, to use this as an example. And this would be true of any idea, moral, spiritual, industrial, scientific, technological, political, economic, so forth. And so I would think the Master Seraphim would have clearinghouses for ideas through human relationships, various kinds of human relationships, and ultimately institutions, human institutions, and that the interactions would spawn ever higher levels of refinement, greater levels of refinement, and then there would be spin-offs from this. We know, for example, from the space program, there are at least 10,000 spin-offs technologically from a variety of new inventions in order to project human beings into space and leaving the home planet and coming back. And you'll see this in the world of art. Look at the Renaissance, for example. The notion of a vanishing point and how this illusion was created in painting by having differentiated repeats of columns or trees that start out large in the foreground and get smaller and smaller in a systematic way. So that the working with human relationships and institutions would be the clearinghouse, it seems to me, that they would assist.
The word clearinghouse is, at least in my own understanding, ambiguous. One use of it has to do with a catalog of junk that some publisher can't sell, and it is going to greatly reduce the prices in the hope of getting some money out of it. But I think that's not the meaning here. That clearinghouse somehow has to do with propelling or motivating or adding energy to ideas. And I think Kristalund's comments point out that, in part, we do not really understand the nature of mind circuits, a fascinating topic that is mentioned in the Urantia book but never explained.
I think you bring up a good point.
Go ahead.
Just wanting to get to the idea of the definition of clearinghouse. So Merriam-Webster says, a clearinghouse, an establishment maintained by banks for settling mutual claims and accounts. A central agency for the collection, classification, and distribution, especially of information. Broadly, an informal channel for distributing information or assistance.
That's pretty close.
Yeah. But it comes from that idea of what literally a clearinghouse is. And I think if we're all familiar with the idea of clearing a check
mm-hmm.
in a bank, the idea is, you know, it's validating whether or not this is a real instrument of commerce, that there's actually funds backing it up, and you know, transmitting it, you know, to the other party that's being paid, you know, getting it to the right place. It seems to me that that central agency idea builds on that idea for the collection, classification, and distribution of information. It's trying to get information to the right place where it could be acted on in the best possible way. So if they're ideational clearinghouses, an idea arises in some place, how can we get this idea over to this person that clearly would know what to do with this? when in fact it's appeared perhaps, you know, over in, you know, Asia somewhere, but somebody over in Northwest Africa or Eastern Europe would be able to do something with that. Just to take an example, what might they have to do in order to do that? Or it could be a matter of how can they illuminate an idea so that it catches hold in a society if it's something that's particularly a social idea. Just some thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
Go ahead, Charles, please.
I alluded to the Renaissance. I've been thinking about it as I listened to Andre's good observation. The Renaissance began in southern Europe and northern Italy. And it essentially established two perceptions or two conceptions, and then that altered perception, which was realism initially in art and humanism. I'll just take humanism as an example. The Renaissance eventually spread to northern Europe, and in northern Europe it eventually took on the humanistic aspect, was interpreted by Martin Luther as he took it further in terms of religion, the focus on humanity, in the context of a God relationship. So he took humanism and he said every man is his own priest, one of the most revolutionary utterances I think ever made. Every man's his own priest. Now, in this paralleled the printing press, which then began to produce Bibles. Bibles were relatively rare to this point. Very few people could read and very few people owned Bibles. But with the printing press, over time, millions could have a Bible. And the Northern Renaissance was transformed in a certain sense into the Protestant Reformation, which sanctioned or legitimized the idea of each person reading his or her own Bible and becoming his or her own priest, if you will. I'm oversimplifying it, but that's the general direction. In terms of illustrating a clearinghouse of ideas, I think this is a valid example. And I could see with a Master Seraphim of Enlightenment, for instance, and the Angels of Progress would work hand in hand with this development. Because you couldn't have the Urantia book read by millions until the idea of the legitimacy of individuals reading and studying religion on their own. In other words, doing it apart from or in sync with the religions of authority. And it was both were done. This kind of, it gave rise to a new kind of liberty of mind and eventually of soul, that you would be encouraged. It was a positive and affirmative action to have access to the word, capital W. And I could see where over the centuries the Master Seraphim would have fostered that development and streamlined it and directed it. I hope I'm making sense.
Mm-hmm.
You always do, Charles.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go on, I'd like to do a station identification. This is the Cosmic Citizen program on Blog Talk Radio. We are discussing aspects of the work of the Master Seraphim as described in a detailed study guide that can be downloaded from the website www.globalendeavor.net. At the bottom of that page, we are currently discussing a question at the top of page 2 of the study guide. I'd like to thank all of you for your insights into the question of circulating ideas by ideational clearinghouse and so on. But before we go on to the next question, I want to make sure that everyone agrees with the presumption built into this question about respect for human will, that the Seraphim cannot override human choices. Does everyone agree with that?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
They don't. They won't.
They won't.
And they can't, right?
They
can.
The
Most High stand back.
I think
in
they can.
Respect.
In the case of some type of emergency, it says that, you know, human will is not without some limitations. So I think that leaves the door open to, you know, the possibility that at some point, you know, something could intervene to usurp human will if, you know, if let's say the state of the whole planet might be in jeopardy?
Well, each of you is entitled to interpret that concept as you wish. My interpretation would be to say that the limitations of human will have to do with the field of focus that the human will corresponds to, and that getting around human will would probably, in my concept, involve exceeding the capabilities or field of focus that the human will is able to address. But I certainly will be happy to yield to others who would
I would say
view.
That certainly one human being usurps another human being's free will on a regular basis on this planet.
Yeah.
Is this because Andre sent you a text message just now?
No.
How did you know? Wait.
No. Wait a minute.
Yeah. No, you know, I think though there's an interesting point being made. First, you know, in the latter part here about, first of all, how many times other human beings usurp each other's wills. That would be one thing. The other thing that, you know, just expanding on Crystalline's point, I would tend to disagree with the idea of an ad hoc usurpation of will or something that would be arbitrary in any way.
Right.
But clearly there are means far beyond anything we can conceive of being able to total masses of human will in ways that you know make our elections look pretty crude, so that at any one point it may be pretty clear you know to those that are governing this world just where the mass of human will is. I mean, we think of it always as one personality's will, and certainly it is. But I think the point was made earlier, it was either by Paula or Crystalline, in mentioning groups, that groups do have a will at various levels, and they express it. And that's corroborated by the idea expressed in the papers where they talk about, the father or deity, you know, but I think it's in the context of the father bestowing more of his presence where more of it is wanted and withdrawing more where less of it is wanted. And it's I'm mistaking the context, and I hope my fellow readers will forgive me on that. But it is with regard to the idea of spirit flowing in and ebbing again where it isn't wanted. It's clear that the Master Seraphim do not impose anything upon us. At the same time, they clearly would be highlighting actions that would be moving forward according to certain individual and collective wills. And, you know, that may be all over the place, but I think you can see partly where I'm going with that idea. Well, here's the other idea that underscores that for me. The life carriers, as soon as human will appeared on the planet, were made to withdraw. Okay? They clearly don't interfere with human will. And you might say, okay, well, that was with life or whatever, but it was clear that part of the mandate of will appearing in life is that will is supposed to take care of life from here on in, that the will that emerges from life is now responsible for the life on that planet. And that is paramount, you know, almost as a prime directive, if you will, on the part of the celestial overseers of us and our planet. They do not contravene our will unless somehow we are contravening it, or there's a collective will that says, you know, of the mass of humanity that is contravening our will. So all kinds of things happen on our planet that many people would say ought not to be happening, and yet they are allowed to happen day in, day out, both good things and horrific things.
This is, it's so, you know, this this concept of will is so crucial to everything. And it's a concept that we could spend a lot of time on. But two things come to mind, and I'm very passionate about this concept of will. The first one is that the Urantia book states that our desire to come to the Father of our own free will is the most priceless and precious gift we can give him. In fact, it's the only gift we could give him that has any value to him. So our desire to come to him of our own free will, therein to be coerced or forced or manipulated, it just, you know, is going against the desire of the Father for us to come to him of our own free will. And the other thing that comes to mind for me is this section from the quote from the Lucifer paper, where it's at paper 54. It says, "How dare the self-willed creature encroach upon the rights of his fellows in the name of personal liberty when the supreme rulers of the universe stand back in merciful respect for these prerogatives of will and these potentials of personality."
Hmm.
You know, I mean, they make it pretty clear right there. This is a universal law.
Yeah.
This is the way things are done.
I appreciate that very much. And I think the point that you're making is immediately related to the idea of individual will. In Andy's earlier comments, he talked about group will, which to me is a sociological or a social construct, not having the same spiritual value as individual will. Would you agree with that, Andre?
Well, it's certainly not, it's not immediate in the same way, and yet I think there has to be a way that you know, at least on a spiritual level and a celestial level, they have a way of totaling it. I don't mean to say how we might interpret that or take a poll, as it were. That, I would agree with you, is purely sociological and you know, part of, you know, mass quantitative political thinking. But I think there's a way that no human could presume to be able to do, but that those that oversee us, in order to respect our will the way that Paula is so eloquently putting it, you know, essentially that's occurring on higher levels. They understand what our will is, both collectively and individually, or there would be no standing back from that. And I think that's probably the signal quote that should have been pulled out in order to underscore this point about the Master Seraphim not stepping on us.
However, you know, we're told at the beginning of the paper that it is through the forces of the Master Seraphim and the reserve corps of destiny. Mm-hmm. You know, that these are the ways in which the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men. So there is,
I think,
some,
there are several words here that are difficult to associate with each other and to delineate their limitations.
Let me continue one thought further.
Please.
Which is that I don't think that human beings are limited in the same way that spiritual beings are limited in their mandates, and that we each can influence one another. We also can, in some cases, usurp each other's wills in ways that are outside the realm of the, you know, the cosmic law. You know, we do all the time.
It doesn't mean it's right, though.
No. I'm not implying that it is.
Okay.
I'm just saying that there must be some ways in which we influence one another that is more, in some ways, more caustic, perhaps, or more more directly, that are not really things that our angels could do or would do.
I think that the various comments from several of you, certainly including what Krystalyn just said, involve the differences between individuals and groups, and it might be possible to explain the work of the Master Seraphim as partially an effort to upgrade the group will to inspire human beings to adopt a higher approach to some particular task. And in my opinion, group will does not have the spiritual character, the sacred entitlement that Paula quite correctly talked to us about in relation to individual will. But if you wish to associate the customs and practices more with tradition than will, that's fine with me. I would simply say that will of an individual in a spiritual sense is not the same thing as the choices and collective will of a group.
Well, one example is that the one that Jesus gives on the cross, where he is speaking to the thieves and he says, you know, you have a right to socially determine what your how justice is going to be meted out, but you should not. Pardon me.
Yeah.
The group has that right.
Right, that the group has that right to make these decisions about how they're going to mete out justice, but you shouldn't worry that this is that those decisions influence the way the spirit realm works. You know, that you may be put to death in a very cruel or unjust or apparently arbitrary way here because of the way the rule of law works in your sphere. But you don't have to worry that this is something that is going to be perpetuated in heaven.
Krystalyn, so, if you don't mind, I'd like to extend your example in the sense that Jesus was speaking to the spiritual destiny of the person to whom he was talking. You've highlighted that. He also said that the customs of the time of the group were a prerogative of the group at the time. Now, I'd like to go one step farther and say that this question of the nature of justice, the nature of criminal procedure, the nature of punishment is, in my opinion, something that the Seraphim, the Master Seraphim, are seeking to influence. So, for
example,
we have a very strong social movement, stronger in some countries than in others, advocating the abolition of the death penalty. Some states of the United States have done that. A majority of states still have the death penalty in their statutes. But I would suggest to you that this question of procedure, this question of tradition, epitomizes the kind of issue that the Master Seraphim are seeking to address and influence on the part of individual human beings and on the part of groups of human beings.
Absolutely. I agree.
Good.
Wouldn't you say, too, Neil, that the goal is the same, that the seraphim are trying to guide us all into the greater will, the will of God? And so whatever they lead us individually or as a group, it's still the same goal to guide us into that higher purpose and that higher will, collectively and individually?
You ask a very good question, and I'm reluctant to try to give you an answer from a position of authority, because I think basically what we're talking about is that the seraphim do not have authority, and that none of us has an authority to interpret these ideas in a way that binds any of the rest of us. But the primary focus of your question, as I understand it, has to do with spiritual destiny. In contrast, the work of the seraphim, although it includes religious elements and spiritual elements, it also includes many, many other elements that pertain to society, that pertain to mind. For example, health as a concern of one of the core of Master Seraphim. And so the Master Seraphim are not exclusively focused on the spiritual destiny of individuals. They are focused on many, many different kinds of questions and issues pertaining to society and civilization as a whole.
I would say they're focused on human destiny, which incorporates all 12 spheres in one way or another.
Human destiny of the planet.
Well, the destiny of humanity on your rancher.
Okay.
That's what I mean by human destiny.
Fine. But you're saying that it is not the individual destiny of human beings who are destined to ascend that they're focusing on. They're focusing on...
That's the responsibility of the guardian seraphim.
Right.
There are two different necessities here. One is personal or individual, individually personal, and the other is collective. That involves worldwide, the various aspects of that, nation states, for example, or the prevention of disease, those are components or elements to the greater good. The greater good is the worldwide rehabilitation of your rancher toward light and life, with light and life in mind. Their respect for mortal free will is the manifestation of their loyalty to God's plan. They have their personalities themselves. They have the power not to respect free will, but they choose not to because they're loyal, meaning that they value God. They value what God has, God's creation. They value God's will, His intentions. The disloyal angels, I imagine, that follow the dark powers, I'm not sure that they would respect mortal free will. But they were removed. You know, I think their disloyalty was probably most acutely manifested in the area of will. In the case of mortals, our free will, when the Master Seraphim are characterized as manipulating circumstances, I do not believe that is done in opposition to human free will directly. They don't force their will. In the totalitarian states of the 20th century, particularly communism, fascism, and Nazism, they intentionally wanted thought control. If you thought the wrong thing, if you had an opinion that wasn't considered correct, that was a crime. It was a felony. It was treated as a felony. It was defined as a crime. And the disloyal angels, perhaps are more in that direction. And the loyal angels, the ones we have now, are all loyal. They're not perfect, but they're all good and holy. And they certainly, the difference between what you can do and what you will do is, or could or should or could or would, are very rather critical. I believe they could do it, but they won't. And that's their glory. That's their beauty. They are loyal.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And that loyalty is something I respect. But their overall, the Master Seraphim are clearly designed to uplift humanity and the various aspects of that constitute humanity. They institute human institutions, human ideas, human norms, relationships, roles, etc.
Just as a footnote to one comment that you made, Charles, I believe recalling that the rebel angels have all now been interned. Am I correct in remembering that?
I think so.
Yeah.
So we're not beset with disloyal seraphim or disloyal angels who were part of the rebellion. They have been confined.
Right.
Thank you.
My point was that the disloyalty, I think, I define largely in the area of will. That's where they were. That's where their disloyalty was really manifested. The disregard.
Well, I agree with your analysis. Yeah. Does any of the other participants wish to add at this point, or should we go on to question three?
I just want to add that I think this question of will, as everybody has pointed out, is signal. It's something around which everything else that we're considering pivots. That there is such respect for will having appeared that we can't fully appreciate that yet in our stage, but it's something that they fully appreciate. They look at it as something entirely precious, valuable, unique, and they want to see its expression. It might also just be worth imagining for a moment that in as much as our will is free and unfettered here, it's not going to be quite so unfettered in certain senses in the next life.
Good point.
We will have to consider the wills of so many others that we're in direct social contact with, including the angels. It's not that anybody will be able to have their will over us. That still will be the case, that we have a free will. But we certainly will be, at every new stage, just even as in human life, we'll need to be considering more and more our ethical relationships with other people, and whether those people are former human beings like ourselves, or whether they're seraphim or any other kind of being. And when you have trouble with your neighbor across the street, or your wife across the dinner table, or your husband, or your children, it's important to just remember that all of these little spats and things to be gotten over are all just window dressing for all the many things that we're going to have to be composing our differences over, which won't be so trivial, but will be much more subtle and won't be allowed to fester and grow into problems that haven't been solved.
And Neil, I want to add one more thing about this idea of will, and I know I've been kind of focusing in on the will of the individual versus the will of the group, and I know that, you know, the Master Seraphim do work with the group, but where it occurs to me, and I know you're heading this way because it's in your paper later on, in some questions you pose, and it really got me thinking about the Reserve Corps of Destiny, and Crystalline, something you said about influence. Certain individuals do and are leaders and do have a powerful influence on other individuals, and that's either for the good or the bad. Jesus characterized the blind leading the blind and both falling into the pit. That would be a bad leader, obviously, but a good leader is an influential person who leads in a positive direction, in a direction of progress, and in a direction of the benefit of humankind. And I think that the seraphim would focus on that individual, especially as pertains to perhaps that person is in the Reserve Corps of Destiny, or perhaps that person is another pivotal individual for the progress of humanity. I think the Master Seraphim would focus then on that individual, only insofar as that person would have a profound influence on the group. So I just wanted to make that point.
Thank you, Paula, and I agree with what you said. I would highlight the fact that in regard to leaders, whether for positive reasons or for unfortunate reasons, it is still up to the people around them to decide whether to follow.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm not aware of any aspiration to compel choices except as highlighted before on the part of totalitarian governments that are either gone or on the way to ending. So the Master Seraphim are not forcing anyone to follow a leader, even if that leader is a member of the Reserve Corps of Destiny without knowing so.
Or brilliant, you know, amazingly brilliant. They couldn't force anything.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, the very essence of evolutionary experience is will interacting with conditions and circumstances and various natures involved. And God's plan calls for the honoring of that evolution, that will and evolutionary experience. The quality of leadership does not countermand that. It's the two are they're two distinctions. In any case, they would not coerce. The Master Seraphim would lead, but they would not coerce. But in any case, every human being chooses, so whether they choose through fear, or they choose through wisdom, or they choose through knowledge, or they choose through their perception of prior experience, or by any other means, to exercise his or her will. When Jesus, I'll give you an example, when Jesus was being beaten, spat upon, mocked, cursed, he chose to remain calm and not to judge these people who were doing that. He chose that.
Mm,
he could have chosen
right.
something else. And we shouldn't confuse circumstances, the characteristics of circumstances, conditions, etc., with will itself. Free will is an endowment of personality, and all personal beings, of course, have it. Angels, men, women, etc., mortals, midwayers, and so forth and so on. All sons and daughters of God possess free will as persons. And that stands apart at one point. That stands apart, functionally at least, and apparently is valued. That function is valued from any circumstance. When people say, well, he made me do it, that's not really accurate. Through fear, you may have chosen to succumb or yield.
Right.
But you didn't have to. There are always at least two options. Gabriel said it, I think it'll be quoted and repeated eternally. He said, there's your way or the Father's way. And in a sense, those are the only two options we really have. The Father's way is universal, providential, working on down through such agencies and means as the Master Seraphim. We should not confuse them. And the capacity to do something doesn't mean you will do it or not do it. That's a separate issue.
Well, and the fact that angels are also in training implies that, you know, they have the ability to do things at varying degrees of competency and success.
Mm-hmm. For certain. I think the context of the Guardian Seraphim, however, is fundamentally different from the context of the Master Seraphim. And there is a kind of authority that is imposed upon the Master Seraphim. After all, they are subject to the orders of the Chief of Seraphim, who wrote this paper. And she has cabinet meetings with the heads of the 12 Corps of Master Seraphim, during which one would assume that they agree on joint procedures and approaches. So the Master Seraphim are operating under a discipline that requires them to operate according to what the Seraphic Planetary Government jointly perceives as being the best interest of humanity.
Less autonomy.
Well, they are part of, in effect, a mobilization which we could equate roughly to an army. although they're not exerting violence in the way that a human army would. But the seraphic planetary government has goals. And there is a discipline, obviously, that applies to each member of the various corps of 12 corps of Master Seraphim. And all of them are subject to the orders of the Chief of Seraphim.
Hmm. You know, you might I think, have illuminated one of the best reasons why they have used, you know, the military analogy for angelic organization. You know, it has, as you said, it has nothing to do with violence. It has to do with how closely angels follow orders. And how subject they are. You know, they certainly have their free will, but it's within very tight boundaries, you know, in terms of what they're able to do. They're not able to function outside of what they've been commanded to do, however broad or narrow that might be in any particular case. And I think that's a very, very important point that you've just made. That's entire justification for that, for referring to legions and armies and hosts and all of that, companies, battalions. I mean, the military, it's clear that they mean to make, you know, a military analogy. Well, in just what sense? That seems to be what's being revealed. Is that they obey orders, and they obey orders for a good cause, in order not to contravene human will.
I think first that these points are very important, and I'm glad that you picked up on part of the implications that I had. In contrast to the human tradition of a military organization in which all orders flow from the top down and are mandatory and so on, my conception of the process would be that in the case of the Master Seraphim, they also are most free to make recommendations upward that are considered very seriously. That these are, they're not passive as Master Seraphim.
Right.
And that the structure of orders they receive is more collegial than strictly hierarchical, but this is an inference.
Oh, and one of the points that was made on the board was that, remember that she, the Chief of Seraphim here, is a very high paradise level primary Supernaphim.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Crystal, then you've just led me into question three. Is that okay?
Yay.
Yeah, there we go.
Let's
look,
do it.
What
Let's
a segue.
Do a station
All
break
right.
real quick again, Neil. This is Blog
okay.
Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen, and we're on with Neil Waldrop and Charles Olivier, Paula Thompson, Crystal and Beek Larson, and Andre Rodatis, and we're talking about the work of the Master Seraphim.
Thank you, Paula. Question three reads as follows. In paper 27, Ministry of the Primary Supernaphim, a Perfecter of Wisdom states, primary Supernaphim are also placed in command of the seraphic hosts ministering on worlds isolated because of rebellion. When a paradise sun is bestowed upon such a world, completes its mission, ascends to the Universal Father, is accepted, and returns as the accredited deliverer of this isolated world, a primary Supernaphim is always designated by the Chiefs of Assignment to assume command of the ministering spirits on duty in the newly reclaimed sphere. Supernaphim in this special service are periodically rotated. On Urantia, the present Chief of Seraphim is the second of this order to be on duty since the times of the bestowal of Christ Michael. A Perfecter of Wisdom, page 298 in the one-column edition, paper 27, section 0. By definition, the Chief of Seraphim on Urantia commands all Seraphim who are native to Nebadon and who are currently serving on our planet. For our purposes, however, the key point is that she presides over the Council of the Chiefs of the 12 Corps of Master Seraphim, a body that we can describe as the Seraphic Planetary Government, which in turn is the title of paper 114. On the other hand, the chief of seraphim tells us that the resident governor general exercises general supervision over the activities of the council and, by implication, over the work of all 12 corps of master seraphim. The chief of seraphim, page 1255, in the one-column edition, paper 114, section 6. Thus, her account establishes that the governor general headed the spiritual government of Urantia when paper 114 was written, and that probably remains the case. Nonetheless, we should not entirely disregard speculation by the author of paper 93 to the effect that Machiavenna Melchizedek may someday appear on Urantia to function as vicegerent planetary prince, representing Christ Michael. And Melchizedek, page 1025 in the one-column edition, paper 93, section 10. Even under such circumstances, the 12 corps of master seraphim would undoubtedly continue to be an important and integral part of the spiritual government of the planet. The divine counselor who wrote paper 17 tells us that, quote, primary supernaphim originate in the infinite spirit, page 205 in the one-column edition, paper 17, section 8. In your judgment, why is a planet primary supernaphim placed in command of the seraphic host ministering on a world that is isolated because of rebellion? Are there factors other than her direct descent from the infinite spirit that may be influential? Why should she assume these responsibilities only after a paradise sun completes his bestowal on such an isolated world? Contextual background. The spiritual framework that applies to the planet's mortal inhabitants changes very significantly when a paradise sun completes his bestowal, for the spirit of truth begins to function, and fusion adjusters are henceforth universally bestowed upon all normal minds of moral status. A Solitary Messenger, page 1187 in the one-column edition, paper 108, section 2. So, many observations in that question. The basic point is why a primary supernaphim as chief of seraphim under these conditions, namely after a bestowal or after a paradise sun has completed his life on the planet.
Well, I have three thoughts. One is she brings no baggage, which is always a big asset. The other angels would necessarily have a lot of baggage. The loyal ones.
What do you mean the other angels would have baggage, Charles? Please explain
that. The ones germane to this local universe.
Oh,
the ones.
And the system.
Do you want to give an example of that kind of baggage? What are you imagining?
They probably would have to adjust and get over their grief over the disloyal angels, their disloyal sisters.
Betrayal. They've been
and
betrayed.
They had no guile, apparently, and all of a sudden they were confronted with those that took on guile and subterfuge and so forth, deception, and they'd have to deal with that. Their perspective would be more limited. Primary supernaphim would have a far broader and deeper view of origin, history, and destiny with regard to Nebadon in particular and Urantia in particular. The primary supernaphim would come here with that long view, that stretching experientially in terms of origin, to paradise. They would have a literal sense of that. That would be a huge advantage over anybody originating from this world and or originating from this local universe. And lastly, in regard to the second question as to timing, why only after a paradise sun? With the arrival of a spirit of truth, there are new possibilities that heretofore had not been available. The arrival of the spirit of truth meant that all these mortals would subsequently have a thought of justice. They would essentially start out life with Daughter Justice, not at birth, but they would, within a few years, several years, all have them. And that opens up a tremendous set of possibilities to interact with Daughter Justice. And that, in turn, would have many spinoffs, all kinds of spinoffs. So that evolutionary developments would now have a spirit foundation they previously didn't have. We may take for granted, or we may not take for granted, that without the spirit of truth and having universal thought of justice, our material civilization would collapse. I believe that, and on Earth, and humanity's networks, political, economic, social networks, would probably collapse, wasn't for the spirit foundation, which began on your rancher 2,000 years ago. So the timing is not coincidental. I believe it's functional. That the primary supranathan brings new capacities for leadership not available in the local universe, and at the same time, the same moving present. The spirit of truth from our Creator Son, Master Creator Son, lets loose, releases a new benevolence in the evolutionary stream, downstepping in the evolutionary stream. So those are thoughts that I have, some thoughts that I had.
Thank you.
Well, and what occurred to me originally when I read your question, Neil, was that she is rebellion proof, like so many, even with the descending suns, are, you know, the farther out you get from paradise, the more rebellion has an opportunity to affect them. The closer you get to paradise, that it just doesn't occur. So that was one thing that occurred to me. And of course, the after bestowal would be the fact that the thought of gestures, as Charles pointed out.
So your point about not being subject to rebellion or default is related, at least, to Charles's point of not having baggage. I think the two things are closely related. Yeah,
I think they're related, yeah.
Yeah. If I may be allowed to interject one additional thought here, we don't know what the personnel, the angelic personnel, may have been prior to Pentecost who addressed these same issues of human society. And a subsequent question in the study guide will invite people to speculate. But it is at least clear that the Master Seraphim are a uniquely experienced group who've been all the way to Seraphington. And the fact that a primary supernatum is a direct daughter of the infinite spirit involves a degree of superior wisdom that probably would commend itself to these master seraphim, even though they have been all the way to Seraphington. But a primary supernatum originates immediately from the infinite spirit. And so perhaps part of the point here is superior wisdom and experience that exceeds the wisdom and experience available to the Master Seraphim, even though they have been through an extremely long period of training.
I think that's true. Your question didn't address the Master Seraphim, so I'd ignored it, but I thought about that, and I agree with you. That's probably another factor in terms of that distinction is probably another factor. But your question focused only on the primary supernatum.
Well, yes. And each person is free, of course, as we all are, to react to these questions as best you wish. And I said at the beginning, there are no perfect answers. And these questions are designed to elicit a variety of responses. Does anyone else wish to contribute on this question?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't know what I want to contribute, but I like the fact that it's that's been asked. You know, the I guess the thing that jumps out at me has already been stated is you know that a primary supernafim is not going to be subject to being tainted by rebellion themselves is another thing that is fairly obvious, but because they're of paradise origin, but that would be important in this case. You know, any time that rebellion has touched anywhere, they're not interested in it gaining a foothold anywhere else, and we're given that kind of precedent by saying, you know, Lana Forge, who is our system sovereign, has been essentially a rebellion-tested system sovereign, and is proven loyal. So, I mean, they go for the big guns when rebellion is involved. Would be one thing that is there right away. But it isn't just that. I agree with the neutrality comments, you know, because of the idea of the different feelings. I'd never really considered what might the various angels and possibly factions of angels. It's not anything revealed, but the idea that angels could certainly have their factional opinions of varying degrees about various things that have happened during the rebellion, all the way from complete disgust about what has happened to some lingering possible sympathy, even though loyalty is there. All of that could be possible in the attitude of an angel.
You're reinforcing the point that Charles made about the Master Seraphim and indeed the Primary Supernafim, who is the Chief of Seraphim, not having any baggage associated
right.
with the previous history of our local universe.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, a Master Seraphim as well. I mean, is not a Supernafim, but is effectively has been proven to be as perfect. You know, is essentially a perfected angel, and is coming back. That's mm-hmm. what they mean by a completion seraphim. There's nothing that they could encounter that is going to throw them off track.
Isn't it amazing to think that 12 cores of them showed up after
yeah.
Pentecost? I mean, it's just astonishing, really, when you think about it, the help that's been given and the changes that have happened in the last 2,000 years, certainly.
I would imagine that they were in the pipeline in the concluding years of Jesus' life on Urantia.
Yeah.
So that there were plans being made.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're talking about a grim issue here, a grim subject, rebellion. In my view, the deepest wickedness or iniquity of rebellion is that it separates persons, material and supermaterial, from God.
Yes.
There's
right.
nothing that means we're separated from our absolute parent, our Father, universal Father, our source and center. That,
our life.
That, in my opinion, is the deepest wickedness of what rebellion constitutes. So to counter that extraordinarily high, powerful, and glorious, and I should make it singular, an extraordinarily powerful and high and glorious being is necessary, seems to me, to counter that, to stand not aloof. High power doesn't automatically mean that you are somehow aloof and not connected, very much connected. But the power and the glory and the beauty, the truth, the goodness, the primary seraphim must, the chief of seraphim must be such, it seems to me, that a very profound contrast is drawn between the shadows and darkness the evil, sin, and iniquity of rebellion at its deepest levels, and light and life. And the paradise experience, the paradise viewpoint, the paradise position, cosmic position, is personified and exemplified for us, the primary supernatant. My guess is nothing less will do.
The analysis and substance that you presented, Charles, is very persuasive, but I would point out that we're talking about a time delay, that the rebellion occurred approximately 200,000 years ago, and the Master Seraphim arrived 2,000 years ago, Chief of Seraphim.
This is a paradise point of view of time.
Okay.
That I'm talking about.
Okay.
It's a paradise perspective.
Well, all bets are off.
Not the genetic viewpoint.
So you'll allow Andre to send in a text message.
There you go.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we obviously don't have time to go on to even reading the next question, question 3. But there were several elements of very interesting discussion that I would like to refer to here and solicit any further comments. We had an interesting discussion about the association with God the Spirit and God the Supreme. We had a fascinating discussion about ideational clearinghouses and the relationship to human will. Now, I open the floor for anyone who has had further thoughts on any of these subjects.
Wow. Well, it's just so much food for thought, Neil. And, you know, I think that we're a part of a divine conspiracy. And, you know, being of the baby boomer generation, evil conspiracies abound and conspiracy theories abound. But what I get from this study of the Master Seraphim and from the study of the Urantia book in general, but is that sense that there is a divine conspiracy, and that conspiracy is that everybody participating conspires to bring the children of God ever upward and inward toward perfection, and that, you know, when you contemplate the eternal realities of the goodness of God and all of his wonderful loyal agencies, you realize ultimately that there's tremendous hope for all of us. And the Father himself is willing that none should perish ever. And Charles, your point that, you know, that the greatest evil of all is to try to cut an individual off from the source of their life, the source of everything that is true and real and beautiful and good, is so poignant to me. So,
yeah.
You know, I go ahead.
Paula, I think you've now given me a tag for you. I can call you a conspiracy theorist. How's that?
Yes, I am. I'm part of the divine conspiracy now.
Or even an activist.
Yes, there you go.
I'm impressed with... go ahead, Paul.
Oh, no, go ahead, Charles. We're down to the last minute and a half, so...
Well, I'm impressed with the organization, the Master Seraphim. I'm impressed with their values and their intentions, their goals, and their loyalty. But I'm also impressed with how they're organized in terms of separation of powers and checks and balances. For instance, the Angels of Progress and the Religious Guardians, and there are probably others. It's highly efficient, but it also acknowledges there will be differences of opinion, there will be dissent between them. So I see in that both those features great wisdom. And I would say the military structure is not an analogy, it's a homology, and we are probably more imitating them than not imitating us. We're really imitating them, and I think the military structure has to do with efficiency and proficiency. And although there's a growing bias about the military, I think it's irrelevant to the nature and functioning of the Master Seraphim in terms of the efficiency and proficiency of how they're structured. But the structure has wisdom and value, worth, and it is it allows for descent as well as efficiency of action. It's a remarkable structure and admirable, I think.
Well, we're down to our last 15 seconds, so I just want to say thank you to all of our listeners, and we'll be back next week. We're going to continue on with this wonderful study of Niels, the Unceasing Campaign of the Master Seraphim. Thanks for listening, friends. And to all of you, my dear friends, thank you for, and Neil, thank you for the effort that you put in on this. It's just amazing and so thought-provoking.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to it as we go on into this deeper.
I'm delighted with all the comments that you participants made today. I thought it was an extremely interesting discussion.
Hear, hear.
Yeah,
too.
I agree. Yeah, it was it was a lot of fun. Thank you for putting this together. It's really quite stimulating, and you know, look forward to taking this up next week. Now, when is our hiatus? When is that? When are we? When do we have another program that is going to interrupt this study, Crystalline?
Well, not until the middle of June.
Well, the middle of June is 2 weeks away.
Oh, gosh, you're right.
Well, 2.5 anyway.
Two and a half, yeah.
I think it would be rash to conclude that two more programs will allow us to finish this. There are 14 pages, and we covered 2 pages today, 2.5.
Right. Well, we haven't guaranteed a time slot, but we have offered to Angie Thurston to talk about her project and to promo her David and Ruth play that she's creating.
Okay.
And so, but I just left it at we'd like to have her on as soon as this is completed. So
okay. Well, that
I think for her time is of the essence because she's trying to gain support for her project before a deadline for her semester, but I don't know what that is.
Well, so June 1st is next Saturday, and then June 8th the following, okay? So the question would be, Neil, is it realistic for you that we covered Origins completely this time? I take it from your comment that you're thinking we're not likely to get through History After Pentecost in just one show.
It's, yes, a conclusion that I would agree with. I think that section, History After Pentecost, goes from near the top of page 3 to near the top of page 8, which would be twice as much material as we covered today. And I don't think that's very likely. I would interject a scheduling commitment of my own. The first weekend of July, I am attending a regional conference to be held in the United Kingdom, specifically in Wales.
Mm.
And that's the 5th through the 7th of July, which would mean that I would not be able to participate in the program on the 6th of July. But
well, why don't
I would
we
say
plan?
This,
why don't we plan that date then for our interruption?
If that is convenient for the rest of you, that would be very helpful for me. I am not sure whether we will have finished the program, the study guide by then. We might. It's conceivable. That would be four more sessions. And if we haven't, then I think it would be very reasonable to assume that listeners who were following us could take a break themselves. But
well, actually,
I don't know
it'll be
whether,
five more Saturdays
whether,
in June. We have five Saturdays.
Yeah, whether your other person can live with the idea of waiting until the first Saturday of July. If she has an issue, I would say this. I don't insist on continuing uninterruptedly. I'm very flexible, and you have been very kind to arrange these programs. Furthermore, I think that each of these questions can be understood on its own merits, and that listeners who tune in next week will not be deprived by failing to hear the questions and answers that we discussed this week. As a routine, I intend to start each of the succeeding meetings by asking people to read through the section. I think that establishes a tone for the ensuing discussion that is necessary. Even if people have heard the section before, it's helpful to start each session of our discussion on this program with a read-through. And that's an additional reason to feel that listeners will not be terribly offended if they have not listened to this program or some subsequent program in terms of the discussion that we have on particular questions.
Okay.
All right. Well,
thank you all. Well, good to meet you guys. I so appreciate it. And were you going to say
I'll
something
put the blurb out as doing history since Pentecost.
Okay,
as covering
or at least the opening parts of that section.
The opening parts of that section, yeah. And
yeah.
to at least look at 4 and 5, some of those questions. I'll do it similar to the way I did it this week. So.
That was very good.
Okay.
Yeah,
right,
good job
guys.
With the blurb. Thank you. Thank you, darling.
Well,
have a great week, you guys.
Yes, you too. Thank you very much,
everyone.
Look forward
to next week. Take care.
Thank
happy
you.
Memorial Day.
Right.
You thank
too.
You.
Thank you, Paula. God
yes,
bless you.
Yes, have a good
Memorial
Day.
Yeah. God bless you.
God bless.
Bye for
bye-bye.
Now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Adios.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book, so all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.